greatest challenge of Judith Heumann's life was not the fact that polio put her in a wheelchair when she was a toddler. The challenge was that the world outside her family's home was built as if people in wheelchairs did not exist. And if you're thinking, that's not so true today, when public buildings have ramps and elevators and accessible restroom stalls, sidewalks have curb cuts, and schools don't silo kids with disabilities into special classes if they're not intellectually disabled, you can be glad Judith Heumann never bought into the idea that disabled bodies were the problem. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Today, Heumann is an internationally recognized leader in the disability rights independent living movement. She served in the Clinton and Obama administrations, was the World Bank's first advisor on disability and development, and was featured in the Netflix documentary Crip Camp, A Disability Revolution. She wrote a memoir last year called Being Heumann and is now out with a version for young readers written with Kristen Joyner called Rolling Warrior, the incredible, sometimes awkward, true story of a rebel girl on wheels who helped spark a revolution. Judy, welcome to Think.
Nice to be with you, Chris.
So your entire life, you've encountered strangers who seem to assume your life is a tragedy because your body doesn't work the same way as other people's. It sounds like it never occurred to you to feel that way.
So I think I recognized, it was ups and downs. So before I was 8 years old, I didn't really feel very different from my brothers or family members. I knew that I was doing things somewhat differently. But when I was about 8 years old was when a boy came up to me and asked me if I was sick. And so really it was at that point in my life where I didn't know other disabled individuals, that people in some cases looked at me as being sick. And of course, when one is perceived of as being sick, that means you're not well, you need additional help. You can't do the same things as other people could do. And that interaction with this young boy was very disturbing. And as I say in the book, it really, however, then made me begin to realize why certain things were happening. Because at that point, I had polio in 1949. And there were no laws on the books that, for example, prevented discrimination in the area of education for disabled children. So when my mother took me to school when I was 5 and pulled my wheelchair up the steps of the school, my parents not expecting anything from the school except to teach me, the principal felt he was completely within his jurisdiction to say, no, I couldn't go to that school because I was a fire hazard. Fire hazard. And that's something when you talk to some other disabled people of my age group, you'll hear that phrase being used in various ways. And then I had no education in kindergarten. And I had a teacher who came to my house for 2.5 hours a week for the first, second, third, and half of the fourth grade. That was a teacher from the New York City Board of Education. But, you know, as I was getting older, I was beginning to really recognize that I was in no way, shape, or form getting the same education as my brother's family members or cousins or neighbors, and began to start thinking about why was that. So I think watching my parents also advocate on my behalf, or learning how to advocate on my behalf, because they were also immigrants. We're German Jews, and my mom and dad were sent out of Germany when they were teenagers. And, you know, it was learn as you were going. And one of the things they really had to learn was whether or not they would accept what society was dishing out, which they clearly were not ready to do. And so they needed to learn how to be advocates, which really was great for me to see them being strong advocates.
At one point, your parents decided to try a local private school, and the school said, sure, we'll take her. She just has to learn Hebrew first. But it sounds like they were not expecting you to call their bluff.
Yeah, my mother was completely believing. After I was denied the right to go to public school, then my parents thought about, as you were saying, my going to a Jewish day school. And there was a Jewish day school that apparently was reasonably accessible. And when my mom, you know, spoke to the principal, I was gonna go into the first grade, and he said I didn't know enough Hebrew. And my physical therapist, his wife was from Israel. And so I remember being taken over to their apartment many times a week to learn Hebrew. And as the summer was drawing to a close, and my mother called the principal of the school and said, you know, I knew enough Hebrew. And of course, that was a joke because I probably knew more Hebrew than most of the kids because I was getting tutors so many days. And then he said, oh, no, it wouldn't work out. Hmm. So I think that was another eye-opening event that allowed my parents to see that people were not always putting forth challenges that they really wanted you to achieve, but rather they were putting, you know, roadblocks in the way that they never expected you to try to get around or get over. But that wasn't who my parents were. You know, it was kind of, we grew up in a family where no was not something that you lightly accepted.
It was not lost on you or your parents that if you had been born a decade earlier and they hadn't left Germany, there's no way you would have survived.
Yeah, I think that's very true, that the Holocaust under Adolf Hitler, the first people that were murdered were disabled people. And I think without, you know, people just didn't think that disabled people's lives were of value. And I think that's still true to a degree today, that some people feel that way. On the other hand, I think the changes that we have seen since the 1940s, really with the development and strengthening of the disability rights movement, really has brought the discussion of eugenics more to the forefront to allow people to see how disabled people were in fact treated at that time, but still for people with certain types of disabilities are still experiencing lack of treatment, where the likelihood of someone dying is more prevalent. Certainly, I think we see with COVID over the last year and a half that were it not for some of the strong disability rights organizations, states were trying to put forward policies that would have allowed disabled individuals who needed ventilators or other kinds of supports either to have their ventilators taken away from them or denying them treatment. And I think it's to the strengthening of the disability rights movement that we really saw many of those regulations not being implemented, and Health and Human Services Administration coming forward, speaking out against some of those attempts.
I'm curious as to your response that anybody would even, to the fact that anybody would even propose this. I mean, I guess it didn't come to that in the United States, but were you taken aback that this was back on the table?
Well, I think we need to look at the fact that it was on the table, in as much as when we look at the number of people who have died from COVID, and you look at people in nursing homes or congregate living programs, or people that were providing services, you see a disproportionate number of disabled people who have died. Anyone in a nursing home has a disability. Hmm. Anyone with what media has been calling underlying conditions like diabetes, hypertension, those are all disabilities. So right now there are about 600,000 people who have died from COVID, and a very substantial number of those people have disabilities. And if the work that disability rights organizations and others had been listened to, what has been said for decades now, there would be an ability for people to be able to receive services in their home and not have to be moving to a restricted living environments where people are at much greater risk of contracting, in this case, COVID-19.
Judy, as the time came to consider college, your counselor made it clear that, like, you would need to choose a major very carefully because there was no chance you would meet a spouse in college. Nobody thought you would date, let alone get married.
So that's really a funny story, Chris, because when I was growing up, what was, I think, another unique thing about my parents is that they did talk about my getting needing to work. They, however, my mom would say to me sometimes, not a lot, but you can't depend on getting married. So you need to be able to get a good education and you need to be able to support yourself. In many ways, that was really, really important because remember, I was born in 47 and in the 1960s, there was still an issue going on about women working. And so I was getting a very clear message that my parents supported my going on and getting higher education. And they felt that I needed to be prepared to work to be able to support myself. So I think that was a very important message. The funny part was when I finally did start going to elementary school, I went to something called Health Conservation 21 classes. These were classes in the basement of a public school. There was no elevator, so the floors above the basement was where the non-disabled children went to school, and the disabled kids would come to the basement because we had a big room, which was both the gymnasium and the cafeteria, but we never ate lunch with the non-disabled children. And so I was really, except for once a week when the disabled kids would go to assembly and we'd sit in the front two rows on the left side of the auditorium. But when I was like in the fifth or sixth grade, we had an occupational therapist, a physical therapist, and a speech therapist that, you know, did therapies with kids in the special ed program. And the special ed teacher called me and her name was Mrs. Malakoff and she was great. Anyway, she called me in her office, she closed the door. I remember this so vividly, it's really funny. And you know, she was a tall woman and she sat down on a little chair and she said, you know, Judy, you are really good understanding the kids here who have cerebral palsy. You should think about becoming a speech therapist. So A, no one had ever talked to me about the type of job I could have, or that I could get a job outside of my parents saying I did need to get a job. And then she said, and you could get a job in a hospital and you could get an MRS degree. Well, at that age, I had no idea what an MRS degree was. And so, you know, I laugh about it regularly when I talk about it. But I think what was really very important with that discussion is that she was elaborating on what my parents had been saying, that I could work. What she added was that I could not only work, but she told me where she thought I could get a job, albeit in a hospital, which really I think continued the thought that if you had a disability, you work in a medical environment. And then she said I could get an MRS degree, which I quickly found out meant I could get married. So those were three very important pieces of information. Honestly, it was probably the most counseling that I got from an adult that didn't have a disability in my entire, you know, elementary, high school. And so I did majored in speech and theater and minored in education when I went to university, because in fact, I wanted to be a teacher.
But you were advised not to tell the U.S. Department of Rehabilitation, which had provided you with a grant to go to college, not to tell them you wanted to be a teacher?
I was told that by my other disabled friends who were a year or two older than I was in high school. What they said was, don't tell the Department of Rehabilitation in New York City. It's funded like about 80% from the federal government. Don't tell them you want to be a teacher because they might say to you, well, show me someone else like yourself who's teaching. And the reality was at that point, none of us knew anybody who was teaching who was a wheelchair user. So they said, tell them you want to be something else. So I did. I told them what Mrs. Malakoff said, become a speech therapist. So I minored in education. And Chris, what was very interesting was, so that was the baby boom era in the 1960s, and there was an extreme shortage of teachers. And so in New York City, obviously, you know, there was a real shortage. And so what they had done is they allowed one to teach if you had a college degree and if you had at least 12 credits in education. And then you had to pass a written and oral and a medical examination. And so I took the 12 credits. Nobody, including my rehab counselor, ever asked me why I was taking those courses. None of my professors, only my friends knew. And then when I had to take my exams, my friends helped carry me up and down the stairs, because each one of the exams given on different dates were in completely inaccessible buildings. And then I ultimately was failed on my medical exam. And the specific reason was paralysis of both lower extremities, sequelae of poliomyelitis.
You understood with perfect clarity that that was discrimination, plain and simple. You were otherwise, you were not otherwise, you were entirely qualified to be a teacher. But I guess at the time, most people didn't think about disability as even a category of discrimination, including the courts.
Well, I think what was going on at that point is there was a change of what was happening. There was a beginning of litigation that had started at state levels, like city levels. In New York City, there was a group called the Eastern Paralyzed Veterans Association, and they were doing a lot of work, as were some other states, with strong veterans organizations, because after the Second World War, there was a new group of veterans who came on with various forms of disabilities. And for those individuals who had physical disabilities, spinal cord injuries in particular, many of those people did not live prior to the Second World War because there wasn't penicillin. So now you had a whole new group of people who came home with an expectation that they were going to contribute in their communities and work and have families, et cetera. But that was something that really wasn't happening because states and the federal government had not yet passed legislation addressing the issue of accessibility, things like curb cuts or ramps on corners of streets or ramps into buildings or doors that were wide enough or bathrooms that were accessible. So that was beginning to happen. And I had, in fact, when I was, I think, a freshman or a sophomore at Long Island University in New York City, I had called the ACLU. And I had said, I think I may have difficulty getting my teaching license because I use a wheelchair, blah, blah, blah. And they said to me, well, if there's a problem, call. So after I passed my oral, I passed my written exam, and I was failed on my medical exam, I did call the ACLU and I said, I'd like to come in for a meeting so we could discuss what to do. And they called me back and said, no, they did not want to meet because in their view, I was not being discriminated against. They were denying me my job because of medical reasons. Now, the ACLU has completely changed since the early 1970s, to their credit, but they were a part of the vast majority of people who didn't see what had just happened to me as discrimination. It's none of the things that happened to me only happened to me. I mean, these types of stories existed all around the country, but I was, I think, fortunate enough to get the support of friends and family and really decided that I was going to pursue trying to get my license after I'd been denied. And I was very lucky to find a really good lawyer who called me one day to ask to talk to me about discrimination in the area of disability. And his name was Roy Lucas. And he was wonderful. And at the end of the discussion, I asked him if he would represent me. That was not why he called me. And he said yes. And then the next day, my father was a butcher with my uncle at a small store in Brooklyn. And one of their customers came in and said that he would also be willing to represent me. So we had two attorneys and we went to court, and I was really very fortunate that the judge we had was Constance Baker Motley, who was the first African-American woman judge to serve on the federal bench. And she basically encouraged the Board of Ed to give me another medical exam, which they did, and I got my license. But then it was very difficult to get a job. Not only were schools not accessible, but many of the principals, while the court might have encouraged the Board of Ed to give another medical exam and pass me on it, some of the principals were not there. So I eventually did get a job back in the school that I had gone to school in, PS 219. Mr. Greenwald was the principal, and he offered me a job. So I taught for 3 years.
There were people along the way who were part of your group who were like, maybe it's time for us to concede a little bit. And you kept insisting, absolutely not. All we've ever done is compromise.
Well, I think it's also important, Chris, to realize that this provision, Section 504, was a part of a law that came out in 1973. And so between 1973 and May of 77, there had been a long process of working on developing these regulations. The Department of Health, Education, and Welfare had a team of people that had gone to a number of parts of the United States, talking to people, both disabled people and those entities that would now be held responsible if they, in fact, discriminated against disabled individuals. So that meant education, that meant transportation, that meant, hospitals, universities, et cetera. And so there'd been a lot of compromising going on between 1973 and 1976, which is when the election of President Carter happened, the Carter Ford election. And so it's not that people were not willing to compromise. It's that we felt that there had been a lot of compromising across the board because the regulations were nowhere near as strong as we would have liked them to be. But in the end, we knew we were not going to be able to get regulations that were as strong as we felt they should be. So there were compromises on both sides for years. I think that's really what was going on, is we felt we could compromise no longer because of what we had done thus far.
What did it take to get President Carter on your side?
I would never say on one hand that he wasn't on our side, because many of us had worked on his campaign. But Secretary Califano, who was the confirmed Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, he didn't really know much about disability from the rights perspective. He was very knowledgeable about issues of higher education and healthcare because he had worked for some of these associations. And, he clearly was a very intelligent man, but he was asking for a degree of review that we strongly believed would have taken us down the wrong road. Now, in 1975, there was an organization at the national level that was created called the American Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. It was a national cross-disability organization meeting people who are blind and deaf and at different physical types physical disabilities, intellectual disabilities, and others were a part of this organization. And one of the reasons the national organization was formed in 1975 was because we were concerned that Section 504 and other provisions of law were not being implemented appropriately. And it really was the creation of this group to kind of monitor, advocate, help disabled people around the United States understand what was happening and get them to be able to participate in the democratic process. And the democratic process is something we should assume, but it's not really taught that much in schools, that people understand. There's a law, there are regulations, there's a federal register. There are all kinds of ways to comment and have input that the government is supposed to listen to. And we had assiduously really followed that whole process. And Carter had said that he would support the signing of the 504 regulations as they were. Ford refused to sign them. He said it was going to be too much. But that was not the Democrats' position. But nonetheless, when push came to shove, what we were really beginning to hear internally from friends that we had on the congressional side and staff and people in government was that there was a serious review underway, and that serious review could have really made the regulations much weaker. So that's what this was all about. And I think in the end, you know, we learned to respect each other. And I think for the disability community, it was really very important that we, you know, stood our ground. And one of the other things that was really important about these efforts was the cross-disability work. And I think, you know, just a minute on that, but, you know, previously we didn't work together as a community. We worked in our silos. And certainly that still happens today. But I would say that one of the values of what happened as a result of ACCD and 504 and many other pieces of legislation, certainly including the Americans with Disabilities Act, is that we really began to recognize that discrimination is something that many of us experience. The remedy to the discrimination may be different depending on your disability. But at the end of the day, it was really paramount that we, as a unified voice, oppose discrimination, oppose segregation, oppose discrimination in employment, in housing, you know, little things that have happened as a result of Section 504. There are now a growing number of disabled people who are becoming doctors. Previously, like before 1980, that was something that was very difficult because there was blatant discrimination going on and a presumption that if you had any type of disability that you were not going to be able to meet the standards of a doctor. And in fact, we see now that's not true. Being a doctor is a difficult thing for anybody, but you know, there are disabled people who are Black and white and Latino and deaf and blind and physically disabled and have psychosocial disabilities, et cetera, who are very qualified doctors. And I think that's a really telling story in a profession that's highly valued, how we are finally getting more people into the profession who have disabilities, as an example.
Judy, do you feel like those very hard-fought legal changes have had any effect on the sort of social effects of discrimination against people with disabilities? Have attitudes changed in this country?
I mean, I do think that people's views towards those of us with disabilities are changing. And I think we see this for many reasons. One, it is more common now for disabled children to be going and attending preschools, elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, universities. So, you know, I talk about it as breaking bread together. There are more disabled people who are getting jobs, period, although the unemployment rate for disabled people is still significantly higher than for non-disabled individuals. But nonetheless, there are more disabled people with various forms of disabilities getting jobs in many different professions. Disabled people are traveling, are going outside of the United States. The laws that we have in the US. That information is being shared with other disabled people around the world. And we're learning from other disabled people in other countries how their countries are addressing discrimination. So yes, there is more happening. We are beginning to see more representation of disabled people in media, in journalism. Still not enough, but groups like the Disability Media Alliance Project is doing work on really helping to expand the voices of disabled people and get the industries themselves to recognize that we must have disabled people in all aspects of entertainment. That's one very important area where the progress is slow, but happening. And at the end of the day, I think most important is that, you know, people who call themselves part of the ADA generation, disabled people from the ADA generation, are really recognizing that they need to take ownership of the movement to be able to not only work on implementation of the various laws, but also to continue to look at what more needs to happen. Removing the barriers, for example, that make it difficult for disabled people with more significant needs to work because they can't get the support that they need. So I think there's reason to be very hopeful. But I want to say one other thing, and that is I am deeply concerned about what's going on in Texas and many other states in relationship to suppression of voting. Disabled individuals, like other minority groups, will be particularly adversely affected. And for me, as a child of immigrant families, where democracy is something and voting is something that was so sacred, trying to deny people, whether they have a disability or not, the right to vote, and to putting a veil around it, stating that you're trying to protect the sanctity of voting, I think is really totally disingenuous. And I really laud the work going on in Texas and in states around the country from the disability community and other allies to really fight against this type of repression.
Very quickly, before I let you go, talk about why you wanted to make sure there was a version of this book for young readers as well as adults.
So the adult version is called Being Human, a memoir of an unrepentant, I'm forgetting my title, that's terrible. I think it was very important because younger people, I think, really are learning about something they previously didn't learn about, which is who we are as disabled people, the kinds of battles that we have faced and are facing. And I think enabling younger non-disabled people and adults with disabilities to learn the stories of many of us, because there are many more people that are writing books about their lives, so there's a lot out there to learn, is really, you know, breaking down a wall, which allows people to see us as human beings having the same goals and aspirations as others.
Judith Heumann is an internationally recognized leader in the disability rights independent living movement and author of the books Being Human and Rolling Warrior, the incredible, sometimes awkward true story of a rebel girl on wheels who helped spark a revolution. Judy, so great to speak with you. Thanks for making time for us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Anna Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. You can listen to Think wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.